In the previous episode, we considered how while individual monks took a vow of poverty, the monasteries themselves had no such commitment. And as a result, they tended to become quite wealthy and plush. Even new movements that began as attempts to avoid that trend, like Cluny and the Cistercians, ended up repeating it. In the early 13th century, a Cistercian monk named Caesarius of Heisterbach described the cycle of monastic life this way, quote, "Discipline begets abundance, and abundance, unless we take the utmost care, destroys discipline. Discipline in its fall pulls down abundance," unquote. Methinks that applies not just to monasteries, but to nations and societies as well. During the Middle Ages, there were frequent calls for a return to the simplicity and poverty of the original apostles, but the popes tended to resist them. That changed with Pope Innocent III. He was open to reform so long as it did not weaken the authority of church officials. A new movement called for the reform of monasticism. Not only would individual monks vow poverty, so would the orders that they belonged to. These were the mendicant orders of Franciscans and Dominicans. The term mendicant comes from the Latin word mendicare, and it means to beg. The mendicant orders relied on begging and almsgiving for their support. Europe of the High Middle Ages, in which the mendicant orders began, saw a number of social, economic, and religious changes. Towns and cities were growing in size and population. They needed more pastoral care than parish priests could provide. Traditional monasteries were of no help since monks lived in isolated communities unto themselves. The mendicants helped local priests by making the world their monastery. They went wherever there was a need, and those needs were, well, they were many. The Franciscans were founded by Francis of Assisi. They concentrated on preaching to just ordinary Christians seeking to renew basic spirit-led discipleship. The mission of the Dominicans was aimed at confronting heretics and aberrant ideas. The Dominicans were approved by the Pope as an official church-sponsored movement in 1216. The Franciscans received papal endorsement 7 years later. And they quickly gained the respect of scholars and princes, popes, along with high regard by the masses, the common people. But their sterling early reputation unraveled in the idleness, ignorance, and even infamy of their later histories. At a time when the spirit of the Crusades was waning and heresies threatened orthodoxy, the Italian Francesco Bernardone and the Spaniard Dominic de Guzman united in reviving the spirit of the Western Church. They started monasticism on a new path. They embodied Christian philanthropy and were the sociological reformers of their age. The orders that they birthed supplied the new universities and the study of theology with some of their brightest lights. But two temperaments could scarcely have differed more widely than those of Francis and Dominic. The great writer Dante described Francis as a flame igniting the world with love. Dominic, he said, was a light illuminating the world. Francis was the most unpretentious, gentle, and lovable of all the greats of monastic life. Dominic was cold, systematic, austere. Francis was greater than the order that sought to embody his ways. The Dominicans became greater than their founder by taking his rules and building on them. When you think of Francis, it's best to see him mingling with people or maybe walking through a field barefoot so that his toes can feel the soil and the grass. But Dominic, when you picture him in a study, surrounded by books, or maybe in a court pleading a case. Francis's life work was to save souls. Dominic's was to defend the church. Francis has been celebrated for his humility and gentleness. Dominic, he was called the hammer of heretics. The two leaders probably met at least three times. In 1217, they were both at Rome, and the Vatican proposed that the union of the two orders be made into one organization. Dominic even asked Francis for his belt. It was a piece of cord, and bound himself with it, saying that he desired that the two be one. A year later, they again met at Francis's church in Assisi, and on the basis of what he saw there, Dominic decided to embrace mendicancy, which the Dominicans adopted in 1220. In 1221, Dominic and Francis again met at Rome when a powerful cardinal tried to wrest control of both orders. Neither Francis nor Dominic set out with the intention of reforming existing monastic orders. Francis really simply just wanted to start a more organic movement of Christians to transform the world. Both Dominic and Francis sought to return the church to the simplicity and dynamic of the earliest church. Their orders differed from the older monastic orders in several ways. First was their commitment to poverty. Dependence on charity was a primary commitment. Both forbade the possession of property. Not only did the individual monks pledge poverty, the entire order did as well. The second feature was their devotion to practical activity in society. Previous monks, you'll remember, had fled for solitude into a monastery. But the Dominicans, which were called the Black Friars, and the Gray Friars, the Franciscans, gave themselves to the service of a needy world. So they weren't in a monastery. They were out in society. In fact, that word friars comes from the Latin fratres, which means brothers. The Dominicans wore black habits, the Franciscans gray or brown, thus their designation as the Black and Gray Friars. Their solitary contemplation was balanced by immersion in the marketplace. Unlike previous orders, they weren't consumed with warring against their own flesh. They turned their attention to battling the effect of evil in and on the world. They preached to the common people, relieved poverty, and sought to redress the complaints of the oppressed. The third characteristic of the orders was that lay brotherhoods developed in both of them. Now, these were called tertiaries, comprised of lay men and women who, while pursuing their usual vocations, were bound by oath to practice the virtues of the Christian life and, as best they could, the values and the rules of the order. Now, I realize some may hear that and say, wait a minute, aren't all followers of Christ supposed to follow Jesus while employed as, you know, a mechanic or the student, salesman, engineer, school teacher, whatever? Indeed. But keep in mind, at that time, the doctrine of salvation by grace through faith and living the Christian life by the power of the Spirit, well, that had been submerged under a lot of religious tradition that sent the message that the only people who could really please God were monks, nuns, and priests. Lay brotherhood was a way for someone to, in effect, say, hey, my station in life doesn't allow me to live a cloistered life, you know, off in a monastery somewhere, but if I could, I would. While the official teaching of the church didn't come right out and say it, what was implied was that most people were hopelessly sinful. But by giving offerings to their local church or monastery, the full-time religious guys, well, they could rack up a surplus of goodness that others could draw on to cover them. Now, as an aside, while that may sound absurd, don't many, in fact, repeat that error today? What about the husband who hopes that his believing wife is religious enough for both of them? Or the teenager who assumes that his family's years of going to church will somehow reserve his or her spot in heaven? You know, salvation on the family plan. You know, the lay brotherhoods of the tertiaries was a way for commoners to say, yeah, I don't really buy that surrogate holiness thing. I think God wants me to follow him and not trust someone else's faith and good deeds. And so there was an opportunity for them, while engaged in their secular employ, if you will, to devote themselves to the life of the order. A fourth feature was the monks' activity as teachers in universities. They recognized these new centers of education held a powerful influence and adapted themselves to the situation. While the Dominicans were quick to enter the universities, the Franciscans lagged behind. They did so because Francis, kind of resisted learning. He was a bit of an anti-intellectual. He was because he had seen the way that too much of the scholarship of the priests ignored the poor. So he said things like, quote, knowledge puffs up, but charity edifies, unquote. To a novice, he once said, quote, if you have a songbook, you'll want a prayer book. And if you have a prayer book, you'll sit on a high chair like a prelate and say to your brother, bring me my prayer book, unquote. To another, he said, quote, the time of tribulation will come when books will be useless and be thrown away, unquote. Now, while that was Francis's attitude towards academics, his successors among the Franciscans built schools and became sought-after professors in places like the University of Paris. But really, the Dominicans led the way and established themselves early at the seats of the two great continental universities, Paris and Bologna. They furnished the greatest of the academics, Thomas Aquinas, Albertus Magnus, Durandus. They were Dominicans. But John of St. Giles, Alexander Hales, Adam Marsh, Bonaventura, Dun Scotus, Ockham, Roger Bacon, they were all Franciscans. Now, the fifth notable feature of the mendicant orders was their relatively quick approval by the Pope. The Franciscans and Dominicans were the first monastic bodies to vow allegiance directly to him, to the Pope, rather than to the Church. No bishop, abbot, or general chapter intervened between their orders and the Pope. He was their direct leader. The two orders became his bodyguard and proved themselves really a bulwark of the papacy. The Pope had never had such organized support before. They helped him establish his authority over the bishops and the cardinals. And wherever they went, which was everywhere in Europe, they made it their business to establish the principle of the Vatican's supremacy over princes and realms. The Franciscans and Dominicans became pretty much the enforcement arm for doctrinal orthodoxy. They excelled all others in hunting down and rooting out heretics. In southern France, they wiped out heresy with a river of blood. They were the leading instruments of the Inquisition. Torquemada was a Dominican. As early as 1232, Gregory IX officially authorized the Dominicans to carry out the Inquisition, and in a move that had to send Francis spinning at top speed in his burial plot, the Franciscans demanded the Pope grant them a share in the gruesome work. The rapid growth of the orders in number and influence was accompanied by bitter rivalry between the two. The disputes between them were so violent that in 1255, their generals had to call on their monks to stop fighting. Each order was constantly jealous that the other enjoyed more favor with the Pope than itself. You know, it's sad to see how quickly the humility of Francis and the desire for truth in Dominic were set aside by the orders that they gave rise to. Because of the papal favor that they enjoyed, monks of both orders began to intrude into every parish and church, incurring the hostility of the clergy whose rights they were usurping. They conducted priestly services. You'll remember something monks were not authorized to do. They heard confession, granted absolution. They even performed the Mass. Again, not authorized to do it. Though they'd begun as reform movements, they eventually delayed Reformation because they degenerated into obstinate obstructors of progress in theology and society. From being advocates of learning, they became props to ignorance. The virtue of poverty was not but a thin veneer for a vulgar and indolent insolence. These changes set in long before the end of the 13th century, which was the same century that the Franciscans and Dominicans had their birth. Bishops opposed them. Regular clergy complained constantly about them. Universities ridiculed and denounced them for their mock piety and abundant vices. They were compared to the Pharisees and the scribes. They were declaimed as hypocrites, and bishops were urged to purge them from their diocese. Cardinals and princes repeatedly appealed to the popes to end their intrusions into local affairs, but usually popes were on the mendicant side. In the 15th century, one well-known teacher listed the four great persecutors of the church as tyrants, heretics, antichrist, and the mendicants. All of this is a sorry comedown from the lofty beginnings by their founders. We're going to take the next couple of episodes to go into a bit more depth on these two leaders and the orders that they founded. As we end, I want to again ask you, if you are enjoying these videos, please like and subscribe to the Enduring Word YouTube channel. Thanks.